Hello and welcome to the Shop With Em podcast. Today we're in for a treat. I'm going to be interviewing an amazing human being who works for the IISD, Mr. Sumeet Bath. I honestly adore everyone who works for the IISD because they're all passionate individuals who are working hard to improve our world. IISD stands for International Institute for Sustainable Development, and they're a policy think tank. The main objective of the IISD, as I understand it, is to influence economic law and policy, which our guest today will speak more about. The IISD also work on sustainability efforts in the fields of energy, water, which will be the main focus of today's podcast, resilience, which is essentially the impacts of climate change around the world, and on spreading the United Nations SDG, or 17 Sustainable Development Goals Initiative, which we hope the world will achieve by 2030. And my personal hope is that we will far surpass by 2030. I'm sure you guys can all understand that I'm a bit of an eternal optimist. As someone whose platform literally centers around sustainable consumption, I'm sure you can appreciate just how excited I am to share today's podcast with you, especially considering how the IISD's Experimental Lakes program is what we have to thank for our laundry detergent, soap, and other key home and personal care products now being labeled phosphate-free. So without further ado, let's get started. So today on the podcast, we have Mr. Sumeet Bath from IISD. Welcome, Sumeet.
Thank you. You make me sound very impressive by using the mister there.
You are a mister. So can you start off by telling us about the IISD? What is it? What does it stand for? And what does your organization do?
Right. People often get a bit confused because there are so many acronyms in our organization. There's IISD, which is the International Institute for Sustainable Development. And that is a think tank that has existed since 1990. It is headquartered and was founded in Winnipeg, essentially as a think tank for policy issues around sustainable development issues. So it's existed since 1990. Ever since then, it's grown, and we do now have offices in Ottawa, Toronto, New York, and Geneva. And we work on five different areas of research. Energy, so different ways to fuel our world. Resilience, so resilience specifically to the impacts of climate change. Economic law and policy. Sustainable development goals knowledge, or SDG knowledge, so the way in which the world is trying to implement the 17 sustainable development goals. And then the program that I work on, which is water. And then from water comes another long acronym, which is IISDELA, which is the International Institute for Sustainable Development Experimental Lakes Area. So the Experimental Lakes Area is a series of 58 lakes in the middle of northwestern Ontario. Very, very unimpressive if you were to look at them. I mean, they're incredibly beautiful, but they're pretty remote, pretty unremarkable, other than they are the only lakes in the world where you can legally experiment on existing real freshwater lakes to determine the impact of human activity. So they have actually existed longer than IISD. They've existed since the 60s. I mean, the lakes have existed for much longer than that. But they've been designated as a site for scientific research since 1968. And the final date I'll throw at you is 2014, which was the date that the Experimental Lakes Area stopped being operated and administrated by the Canadian government and was then taken over by IISD, the think tank.
Why was that? Why would they transfer, control over these experimental lakes?
So the Canadian government decided not to fund the Experimental Lakes Area anymore. So there were a series of questions about what would ultimately happen. And it was a really valuable resource because it's the only place in the world where you can conduct these kinds of experiments first up. Also, ever since 1968, it has been conducting a series of monitoring that we do literally every day to determine the health of the lakes, everything from the chemistry to the temperature to the depth of the ice to the air temperature that we've kept since 1968. And that needed to be maintained because it is the longest database of its kind in the world. So not only did we want to maintain that, we wanted to continue to be able to experiment on real lakes. There are always emerging threats. So we wanted to be able to keep the experimental lakes open because really it's a one of a kind facility. So it was fledgling for a bit. There were questions about whether or not it would stay open. And if it were to stay open, who would then take over its administration? And so the International Institute for Sustainable Development, which is a policy think tank, decided to take it over, take over operation because it made sense in a lot of ways. You'll often hear the phrase bridging science and policy, which sounds very impressive and a little confusing, but essentially what it is it's taking science, so scientific findings from all of the scientific research that goes on in the world in all different pockets of science, and actually then turning those findings into policy that is enacted by government and industry so that it can really impact the people that matter. Now, a question that I often get is, well, doesn't that happen anyway? Isn't that obvious? And unfortunately, the answer is no. I mean, to a certain extent, yes. You know, we'd like to think that there are politicians and people who work in industry who take what scientists say seriously and listen to, you know, new scientific research that's coming out and recommendations from scientists, but it doesn't always happen and it isn't always a given. And sometimes it's not for lack of will, it's just for lack of infrastructure for those findings to be able to be communicated in the right way to the right people.
Right, so, because society has like a really huge play in there, right? So politicians want to get elected. What matters to the people right now? It's not necessarily the science. It's, you know, if I support this person, they'll then fund my campaign. Is that what you're saying?
To a certain extent. So, I mean, often it's just a case of the fact that policymakers aren't aware of the science that's taking place. So scientists will publish in scientific journals or publications, or they will present at conferences. And as fascinating as those scientific papers are, I'm going to bet that policymakers probably aren't reading them on a daily basis. So it's just down to the fact that policymakers don't have access, first up. Secondly, even if they do, they may not fully understand the scientific language that's used or what the potential import of those scientific findings are, because scientists and policymakers don't necessarily speak the same language. So there is a question, and that's where the International Institute for Sustainable Development comes in, because we are essentially policy analysts. So we speak the language of policy, but we also have a scientific research facility that we operate. So we're able to act as those intermediaries, as those translators, I suppose, to be able to take the scientific findings and say, look, this is what you need to do in this instance. This is the current policy landscape. If we're meeting with the minister, if we're meeting with the policymaker, we say, okay, This is the current state of play. This is how policy currently looks. We've just found that X causes Y. So therefore, in your jurisdiction, it's probably best if you change X so that Y doesn't happen.
So I have to ask then, because yes. I heard from one of your colleagues that the ELA are the reason why we see phosphate-free on most eco-friendly laundry detergents nowadays, and like just in general products. So can you talk about that? Like, when is this what you're essentially trying to tell me?
So this is basically our classic original experiment. This is the reason why the experimental lakes area exists in the first place. So remember I said we started in 1968. Well, the impetus for starting was because across North America, there was a blight of what we call algal bloom. So those horrible kind of green sticky layers of slime that you'll see on lakes. And scientists, for the life of them, could not figure out essentially what the cause of algal blooms was. And there were a series of experiments in laboratories, and they were testing with nitrogen and phosphorus and carbon and all different combinations of the three. And a group of Canadian scientists got together and thought, look, this isn't working and we're still suffering from the impacts of algal blooms. And algal blooms are harmful because they can affect the chemistry, they affect the chemistry of the lake. They can be toxic to those who reside within the lake and to people and to human beings who drink the water. So they're not only are they unsightly, they're quite a health hazard too. So the group of scientists went to the Canadian government and said, look, here in Canada, we have literally millions of lakes, literally. I'm using that word literally. And they said, why don't we cordon off a few? Why don't we safely experiment on them and manipulate the lakes so that we can actually add these nutrients, into the lakes, which are we know one of them is the culprit. We just need to determine which one. And if we experiment in a real lake ecosystem, we're far more likely to have accurate results because we're seeing the true interplay of different elements within an ecosystem. And not only will we determine what the cause of algal blooms is, we'll be able to see a whole bunch of knock-on effects too. So maybe it affects the food web. Maybe it affects the different layers of the lake. Fast forwarding a few years, they experimented. They tried different combinations of the different nutrients and discovered that actually phosphorus was the major culprit when it comes to algal blooms forming. It's a process we call eutrophication, which you may have heard before. So then there was a series of policy changes that occurred around the world to essentially, and the policy changes were within government and were within industry, to essentially reduce the amount of phosphorus that was allowed within a whole suite of products that you wouldn't even imagine, everything from dish soap to soaps to cleaning products. So that's a really interesting example of the potential for science to impact policy. And there's a whole series of stories like that. We've worked on mercury, we've worked on acid rain, but that's kind of our classic original experiment.
Take me through it though, consumer, like how that affects us as consumers. So the phosphate goes into our water when we're washing our clothes and then obviously our dishes and such. And what you're saying is it ultimately ends up back in oceans?
Yes. Well, so remember, first up, we're talking about freshwater lakes.
Right.
So, yeah. So the chemistry and the movement of water will be a bit different from freshwater lakes. So there are a series of ways that phosphorus can end up in the lake. So one of them could be through consumer products. So say, for example, you're washing your dishes or you're cleaning your clothes using a washing machine. Right. Yeah, exactly. Using a detergent that contains certain phosphates. Now, those will wash through and ultimately end up at a wastewater treatment plant that will then leach out into our drinking water. And we would want to make sure that, first up, the wastewater treatment plant would have the necessary stages and filters in place to filter out things that are harmful to humans. However, A, that's not always the case, and B, there's also much water that then just leaches out naturally back into our freshwater lakes, often without having gone through a treatment system. And the problem is then that the bacteria that feeds on that then ultimately proliferates to become algal blooms needs phosphorus to be able to grow. It also needs nitrogen, but nitrogen it can fix from the air, but phosphorus is what we can limit entering those freshwater systems. And it's not just consumer products. There's also a great amount of phosphorus that is found occurs naturally within nature, but also is used in fertilizers on agricultural land too, that then leaches out and into our freshwater lakes. So there are a series of ways it can enter.
So the phosphate-free kind of campaign and policy was created mostly for the environment. There's no actual dangers for human health when it comes to having that much phosphate in like laundry detergents, dish soaps, etc.
I'm not 100% sure about that. I'm not sure, but what I do know is that it matters for the environment, but it does also matter for human health, because algal blooms can affect the health of humans and animals that are around or in a lake or drink from it. So it will make the water toxic to humans and to animals who live within the lake.
Yeah, of course. We have to respect Mother Nature. It's going to come back to us. Karma, right?
Of course,
So you mentioned earlier that it's the depth of ice and so on and so forth as well. So I'm from BC, so maybe I'm just, you know, really ignorant here, but I just assumed that the lakes were, you know, freshwater, still lakes, out in the countryside, and I didn't really think that they would go that far up north. So are all of the lakes mostly frozen, or is it kind of like they freeze in the winter years, or in winter months, sorry, and then they're defrosted, or just like, you know, still water the rest of the months?
Yeah, so I should have clarified, we're only measuring depth of ice during the winter, but I just wanted to, to illustrate the fact that we actually work year round. So as fun as it may not sound, we always have researchers out at any given time of the year who are experimenting on the lakes or just monitoring the lakes for the data set that we keep for the health of the lakes around the year. So even in January, and I've been out on the lakes, and it's quite the fun process of having to set up a tent on the ice and drilling a hole through and measuring the ice, and then going down to different depths with a little sampler and taking samples of the water and measuring the temperature. Because even when a lake is supposedly iced over, it's not still. There's still many things that are happening beneath the ice. There are still animals that are living there and that are moving around. We track the movement of fish, for example, all throughout the year, including the winter. There's always plenty of stuff happening. I had the same assumption before I started here. I just assumed that a frozen lake was just frozen and nothing was happening, but there's always some interesting stuff going down.
And Ontario's climate too. So it was a bit of a dumb question, but also it's like one of those like, oh, that's not really something I thought about. So like, what are some of the other studies that you guys are doing right now that affect public consumption?
There are quite a few. So the major one that we're working on at the moment is the impact of oil spills on fresh water. Now, we've worked for years to try and get this experiment off the ground, and we've got a series of collaborators on board, everyone from local communities and First Nations to actually the oil industry itself. And what we're doing is we've set up a series of enclosures, and within those enclosures, we've actually intentionally spilled dilbit, which is short for diluted bitumen, which is essentially the form in which most oil in Canada is transported in pipelines. And what we're doing is we're replicating the impact of a pipeline spill in freshwater to see a series of things. Number one, how oil behaves when it hits a freshwater lake. Number two, the impact that it may have on the shoreline and on the wildlife. And number three, the best remediation or cleanup techniques. What the best solutions may be for cleaning up a lake after a spill. Now, the question we get all the time is, well, can't you just experiment on real oil spills? You know, when they happen, can't you just get your scientists down and get their little samplers out and start experimenting? But the thing about the experimental lakes area is that we can control everything. We know what the lake was like before the oil spill occurred. We know what it's like during, and we were able to clean it up after. So we've got all that baseline data, as we call it. So that's a really interesting experiment because it's never been done before, but B, because we're working with a series of different stakeholders, including the oil industry itself and the pipeline industry itself. Because, you know, talking again about that, you know, bridging science and policy, making sure that science impacts policy immediately, we're working with everyone to make sure that whatever we find about, you know, what the best cleanup methods are, how oil behaves in water, we've got everyone on board to make sure that that will have an immediate impact. So that's actually a really exciting experiment that we're doing. We're also continuing to look at the impacts of acid rain. So acid rain, you know, everyone kind of assumes that it's a concern of the 70s and 80s, and now we're done. But what we found, we did an experiment back in the 70s when acid rain was really, really hitting the headlines. And we wanted to see what would be the impact if you acidify a lake. And what we found was a series of different things. Basically, it's not good. But what happened was a species of shrimp called mysis was completely removed from the lake, completely gone. And that affected many of the other animals in the lake, including the fish that fed on them. So now, fast forward about 40 years, we're reintroducing that shrimp. And we want to see what that means, because it may be that the mysis is able to re-thrive in the new environment. It may be that the shrimp isn't able to survive. And that will teach us a lot about how freshwater lakes around the world are recovering from the impacts of acid rain. And then the third really exciting one, which hasn't gotten off the ground yet, but we're still working on rolling it out, is the impact of cannabis. Oh. Now, as you know, you're also based in Canada. Cannabis was recently legalized for recreational use. So given that there's been a change in the policy landscape, and there may be a change in the legality, there is a change in the legality of a substance, we could potentially expect that there would be a higher rate of use. So what that would mean is there are more people that are consuming cannabis. There are more people that are excreting it through their urine into toilets, into sewage. And that could mean that there is more cannabis, or the metabolites, so what the cannabis becomes after it's gone through a human body, into the lake. And the problem is, we don't know what happens when cannabis or its metabolites hits that lake. So it could be consumed by fish, and it could affect fish populations. It could change the chemistry of a lake. It could do a whole series of different things. So we are starting, I think we're just starting the very preliminary stages of research this summer on that research. But that's really interesting, because
fascinating. That's not something you think about. Is like, you know, it gets excreted through your urine and then it goes back into the water system. And that's really fascinating.
I remember when I first started here, actually, I mean, I don't have a history. I don't have an educational history of science or freshwater science. So I had these same kind of questions, too. And we were just releasing the results of an experiment, a similar experiment on the impact of artificial estrogen that's found in the pill. So the results have just come out, and it's the same process, right? You know, the estrogen and its metabolites are excreted through urine, go through the sewage system, some of which ends up in our lakes. And we found in this instance that actually artificial estrogen had feminized some male fish. So some of the male fish had actually started to grow eggs in their testes because of the impact of estrogen. I know, that was my exact reaction too, such is the impact. And these are things you don't think about. I mean, if you think about the number of pharmaceuticals we consume in North America, and we obviously, you know, we consume them in our body, we excrete them, even though the water may go through a wastewater treatment plant, the treatment plant doesn't treat for everything. And if it doesn't know to treat for cannabis, or it doesn't know to treat for estrogen, and those safeguards aren't put in place because there isn't the scientific evidence to inform that policy, then they don't, right? So there are a series of pharmaceuticals that we have to consider. And that's, you know, I wish we had 500 lakes we could experiment on, because we could do far more experiments on those kinds of impacts.
So once you experiment on a lake, does it mean you can't experiment on that lake anymore? Or is it you have dividers in the lake to separate it? Another dumb question, I'm sure, but I have to ask.
It depends. So for the oil spills experiment, we've actually got physical enclosures. So there's a plastic sheet that goes from the top of the water right down to the bottom. It's right in the sediment. It's the whole rest of the lake is protected. Now, with some of the lakes, they are actually whole lake experiments. We're experimenting just on the real lake. But yeah, there are a couple of things you have to remember. Number one, these lakes were chosen because they have very small watersheds. So the actual basin of the lake doesn't really bleed into many other lakes. So it's somewhat self-contained. And secondly, within every proposal for research that we get, so we get research proposals from our own scientists, from scientists across the country, from different universities, it goes through a rigorous process. And this process of approval includes it must have a plan to remediate the lake after it's done. That means cleaning up the lake after it's done. So I say that we have access to 58 lakes and their watersheds. At any given time, we're not experimenting on all of them, partly because we don't have the resources, but partly because most of them are currently in the process of remediation. So we could be using another chemical to try and clean them up. We could be letting them the lakes relax so that they naturally clean up. But each lake has to be returned to its original state by the end of the full cycle of research so that it could then ultimately be experimented on again.
So you spoke about, like, obviously the estrogen story and how it ends up going back in the water. And I mean, you're a man, so I'm sure you're concerned about that if, you know, such a thing happened to some male fish. But like, how has all of this work impacted you in your own life and the way you see the world?
No, that's a good question. I mean, first up, you know, I think it's given me a more critical eye when it comes to looking at nature. I'm very much a city person. I'm from London, England, originally. And I really don't understand natural systems in a very well because I didn't grow up around them. My attitude was always, oh, you turn on a tap, water magically comes out, you use it, and then you're done. But I think it's really made me understand that actually my actions have a strong impact on nature. And we really depend on many natural systems to keep our lives going, even if we live in an urban environment. And that there's also so much that we don't know about the impact that we have on the environment. I had this very lazy assumption, this very layperson assumption, that if a new drug is introduced onto the market, or if we start using a new nutrient in fertilizer, that there were automatic safeguards in place just to make sure that they didn't affect our water. But my understanding now is that that's a way more complicated process, that often these things don't happen, that we still don't have a full understanding of our impact on the environment, and that policy doesn't necessarily reflect the dangers that humans or the environment face. So that there is actually a lot of work to do behind the scenes. So I'm the communications manager for the Experimental Lakes area, and a lot of work that I do is yes, working with policymakers, but also just trying to translate the science and the work we do for the general public. I try and work on communicating the specifics of our experiments, but also just the basic concepts of science that lots of people don't understand. We'll put out blog posts on the role of carbon in water or why calcium is important to freshwater fish and shrimp, what a wastewater treatment plant looks like. I think that lots of people don't understand these processes that go on behind the scenes and how integral they are to our everyday life. So it's really had a big impact on my life. I look at a lake now and I think, you don't know what is floating in that lake, and you don't know what the safeguards are around you to protect that lake. And it's not for lack of goodwill. It's just sometimes, you know, these are complicated processes that don't necessarily automatically happen. So yeah, it's had quite the impact on my life. Now I know what the thermocline is as well, which is so all of these very technical scientific terms that all the scientists were throwing around when I first started. Now I'm like, oh, I think I know what that is. I think if that came up in Jeopardy, I think I'd know how to answer that question. I think I'd be all right.
I love that show's still on air.
me too.
If we can leave the listeners with something to consider with regards to their future consumption patterns, what should that be I don't know if you know the answer to the question, but like I'm just hoping from, you know, the fact that you work with this organization and your own life experience, a lot of people are looking to go more sustainable or, you know, go a bit more zero waste, and everybody's kind of trying things out in their own life. but like, what are some key things that you found we should, you know, definitely keep our focus on when it comes to future consumption patterns?
I think the basic lesson, and this may be a bit rudimentary, is just really recognizing the impact, the potential impact of the consumer choices that we make, and recognizing that we may not always understand what those impacts are. I was thinking a few weeks ago about the fact that yes, phosphate, most detergents and dish soaps are now phosphate free, and that's great. And we should be thankful for the fact that there were mechanisms that allowed that to happen, and that there were the right policymakers at the right time, but that is not always the case. And sometimes it does take a bit of research or just a bit of critical thought on the part of the consumer to think, okay, this product contains X, or there's quite a lot of Y in this product. Maybe I should do a bit of Googling to determine exactly what the impact could be. I also think that in educating yourself and making yourself more aware of the impact of your consumer choices and of your just day-to-day lifestyle choices, you can have a real impact on the political process that is there to protect you and the environment. I think about, for example, the recent public surge in interest in plastics and microplastics, which we're actually doing an experiment on at the moment. And it's a really interesting example of how political movement, because you've seen, I can't move for hearing stories about how single-use plastics have been banned here, or now microbeads can't be used in this country. Like there's been real political movement, and I genuinely think it's down to public outrage. I think about, for example, that episode of the BBC's Blue Planet, where you see physically animals that are trapped in plastic. And I think that those kind of images were really impactful on the public. And that was a really pragmatic example of how that outrage was transferred into political movement. And you're seeing it more and more, not just in the environmental realm. I think there's a real feeling that the public can be mobilized and have impact on the political process. So I wouldn't lose faith. I think that, you know, as you said in the beginning, politicians work for us, and policymakers and industry ultimately have to work for us, because we are the electorate, we are citizens, we are consumers. So it's really, really important to remember that and to be able to use it. Yeah.
Right. And you also mentioned they don't know everything, too. So sometimes when you go and you bring up an issue to them, they're learning through you.
Absolutely right. And if there's not enough of a critical mass, they will definitely listen, because even just for the very crude matter that their political career may depend on it.
Very true. So what I heard from you is read labels and educate yourself. Mm-hmm. You have a political impact. Do you drink filtered water? Is that important to you?
I actually don't.
What? You just told me that estrogen story.
You know what? I should heed my own advice. I'm running out to buy a filter right after this interview. Do you?
Awesome. Yeah, of course. I have like a huge one. I just fill it up with tap water and then I keep it going throughout the day. I have to drink at least 40 ounces of water a day. It's like a thing. So awesome. It was really amazing chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time. And I do have to ask you though, when you were talking about plastics recently, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I was reading about biodegradable plastic recently. When you guys do your microplastics like experiment, are you going to be exploring bioplastics?
No, I don't think that's explicitly on the docket. But one thing to remember about microplastics is they're essentially just small plastics. So they represent what happens when plastics degrade quickly. or over time when they become very small particles. So there is, I can't speak definitively on this, but there is the potential that microplastics could also represent biodegradable plastics haven't broken down, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, because whenever I see them, I don't trust it. I don't know. Yeah, it's apparently a part of the other category when it comes to plastics. I was researching that for social media recently, and I just went, I know it says biodegradable, but I don't trust that. Anyways, so thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it was great.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Shop with M is a digital platform which includes a website, mobile app, documentary series, and regular podcasts for all of you socially conscious, values-based consumers. My mission for Shop with M is to create a platform where consumers looking for sustainable solutions can find brands analyzed for the left-brained consumers and video and audio content for the story-empowered right-brained consumers on each of the 5 factors for sustainable consumption. These brands are easily accessible to you for free through both the website and mobile app. The purpose of the Shop With M app is to connect you with sustainable businesses around the globe. Businesses including retail, grocery, and cafe restaurants, with the vision to expand in the future into other categories, and of course, continue to produce inspiring and informative video and podcast content. On a legal note, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect that of Mangla Bunsell, Tell Your Story Productions, Inc., and its subsidiaries, affiliates, and associated companies, together with all respective officers, directors, and employees thereof. Thank you for being such an important part of our community. If you have any suggestions for future guests who should be on our podcast, please email podcast@shopwithm.com. Thank you. The love and light in me salutes the love and light in you. See you next time.